Audi.
Hello, I'm Lisa Francesca-Nand, and you're listening to the Big Travel Podcast. This episode could not be any more travel-y if I tried, but just before I get onto that, I wanted to ask you to head over to iTunes and leave us a little review and subscribe from whatever way you're listening. That way you don't miss out on any of the guests we've got coming up, which include Andrea McLean from ITV's Loose Women, author and Twitter star Giles Paley-Phillips, PR guru and presenter of the Media Masters podcast, that's Paul Blanchard, and many, many more. On to today's guest, though, who is travel royalty, and I'm sure you're going to love him. To whom does the world turn when there's a travel story in the news, when they've been ripped off by a rogue merchant or just want to plan their next trip? To Simon Calder, of course, our best known travel expert. He's the man who pays his way. He's hitchhiked all over the world. And he's also the man who over 12 years ago gave me my first official travel writing commission. So I owe him everything. As an impoverished travel writer, I can't, of course, offer him money, but I can bring him onto the Big Travel Podcast and share his wonderful wisdom with the world. Please welcome, for this travel-packed episode, Mr. Simon Calder. You are Mr. Travel, and everyone in the UK knows you and loves you. You might not be aware of this.
You should see my Twitter feed when I venture things about the railways, which aren't perhaps completely in tune with what commuters think. And then I some very fairly strong emotions, none of which can remotely be described as love.
I think the contrary, whenever I've told anyone that I'm going to be interviewing you, like, and I put this out on my Facebook page yesterday, and I'm going to read you some of the comments, My friend Sally, who's a very sensible mother of two from Oxfordshire, she said, I love him. Can you ask him? I almost didn't tell you this, but because you might feel a bit uncomfortable in a closed room with me. But she said, can you ask him to sign my pants if I post them to him? And lots of other people, I love him. Can you give him a kiss from me? Says Judith. We've got...
I'm from Crawley. I'm not used to this.
Who else have I got? I've got... can you sign my pants? David Robinson said, he's an Abtus superstar. Upset him at your peril, Chessie. I was like, I'm not going to upset you. Jackie Vaughan says, I love him too. Can you ask him what he dreads to be asked?
Ah, I dread to be asked that question. you can ask me anything you want to. I will try and be helpful and honest and straightforward.
I dread to be asked, as a travel professional who's travelled about 10% of what you have, I dread to be asked what's my favourite place, because I honestly can't choose something. And I'd probably say London, because I live here.
Yeah, that's a very, very good... answer. Should I do my
favourite
place?
Do it.
Well, it's probably when the sun shines, Scotland, which it does sometimes, and every year I try to go to a new part of Scotland. It's a vast and wonderful country, and it's terrific in terms of not obviously the mountains, because last year I climbed Ben Nevis for the very first time, and I mean it's just a big hill, which isn't particularly attractive on the world scale of mountains, and that's as high as it gets. But it does have the character of being able to look astonishingly moody, and the combination of feeling that you're at the raw edge of the earth, where you are, particularly on the Western Isles, somewhere like the island of Harris, which of course is same part of the same landmass as the island of Lewis in a strange Scots way, you just feel that this is maybe the final frontier. So Scotland's pretty good, and you can also get to, of course, these days, very decent food and drink, easy to get to, relatively easy to travel around, and what's not to like, apart from occasionally the weather and sometimes in summer the midges.
That's what I like about you. Your travel is very accessible. You're not fancy, are you? You're not one for like going to 5-star resorts. I do all that stuff for you.
I know, it's so good of you, Lisa. It's fine. I've glimpsed inside some of them. I was hitchhiking through Greece once and got a lift with the manager of the Mark Warner, who took me there and said, here you are, help yourself to lunch. I couldn't believe it. The best thing which had happened all week.
And did you hit the champagne bar?
No, I didn't, funnily enough, but I did enjoy that. And I've had a warm feeling for the company ever since, of course. And I took my family on holiday, and that was just fine. But I think really posh places, I feel sort of slightly uncomfortable. Doesn't this happen to you? You go into a hotel lobby, And somebody's trying to pick up your case.
Yeah, I feel a bit uncomfortable at that. We're British people aren't very good with the whole, shall we tip? Can I just carry my own case?
Okay, you can take your own case, but I'm going to come with you to the room so you can tell, I can tell you how the lights work. Yeah. Well, I've been in hotel rooms before, pal, and I know how the lights work.
I hate that awkward moment when they're showing you around and you're kind of standing there and you're thinking, get out of my room, this is just awkward, shall I tip?
Is it $5? What's he expecting? It's all just, it's quite tricky and you don't get any of that at the lower end of the budget scale, I would say.
Yeah, stick with the lower end. I'll get onto that because I'm very interested about the man who pays his way. And I know a lot of people are interested about that angle of thing because, you know, a lot of travel is sponsored. So it's very interesting. But let me carry on with my listener questions. Ooh. Sam Brown says, can you ask him about the future of the package holiday as it seems to be in decline with more and more people booking separate elements rather than the traditional package?
Sam, that's such a pertinent question because July the 1st, an absolutely key date in the history of the package holiday, that is when everything which looks like a package holiday becomes legally a package holiday, and that's really important. Now, the package holiday was the way that many of us began travelling. I mean, I know you were already in Spain, lucky you, but those of us who had to, who didn't have family and roots there, had to get there somehow, and it was obviously far too expensive to fly on the scheduled airlines, so instead you buy a package holiday. And it was the original low-cost travel. They fill up planes, they fill up hotels, they put on the connecting buses, and it's a great business model. It started to unravel in the noughties when the big package holiday companies, that's Thomson as was, TUI as is, Thomas Cook, etc., failed to recognize what was happening. Thomson and Air Tours both had a go at getting into the sort of low-cost airline business. They both really failed in terms of getting a scheduled operation up and running, and they were just kind of left behind. And in the vacuum that was created of people wanting, actually, I don't want to go for a week, I want to go for 6 days or 9 days or whatever, and I don't want to stay in that hotel, I'd rather find that place down there. That was filled by people doing it themselves, which is great, although I've made plenty of pitfalls now, I dare say even you have, in messing up bookings, but also by online travel agents who just said, ha, we'll sell you the perfect holiday, and it's only when you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page that says, oh, when we say holiday, we don't actually mean we're going to sell you a holiday. What we're going to sell you is flights direct from this airline and accommodation direct from this hotel. If you've got any problem, off you go, sort it out with them. Now, 1st of July 2018, all that changes for purchases made from that date onwards. If it looks like a package holiday, it is a package holiday with all the rights that come with it. And if we can just go back over a few of the recent calamities, let's say the collapse of Monarch, at that point, people who booked through an online travel agent were basically just told, you're on your own, you might have to buy new flights at six times what you originally paid. Package holiday companies have much more of an obligation to find alternatives for people and to help them complete their trip. So package holiday is very good, Sam. Thank you for the question. And actually sort of coming back, and I think the more that people understand the consumer protection that comes with a package holiday, which is basically from the moment you turn up at Gatwick or Manchester or East Midlands, the holiday company has to deliver what it's promised you. The more people understand that, I think they will continue to flourish.
I know, anecdotally, I know lots of people who still book packages, actually, especially people with young children, because I think it's just easy. And okay, we did have the freedom to look around and book hotels and search for the cheapest flights and everything, but sometimes it's easier to just get it all done for you. What people don't do is go into a travel agent and do it. People tend to just do it online.
Yeah, well, a proper travel agent who you can talk to, whether that's someone on the phone, whether it's somebody in your high street you go and see, is really, if it's somebody you trust and who understands what your holiday needs are, that is absolutely invaluable. And yeah, you might end up paying a bit more, but it's worth it because you're using the services of a professional. What I would caution people against going on the internet and just putting in cheap flight to Malaga or going through a search engine to find a cheap flight and then just booking through the first agent they see, because online travel agents, they have a perfectly good place, but you are probably going to find that if things go wrong, you're not going to get the kind of help that you might want. So I get multiple cases of people who have booked a a flight, maybe misspelt a name. Now, if you'd done that direct with the airline or with a good travel agent.
Granada in Spain instead of...
Grenada, yes. How many more of those? Dulles in Washington rather than Dallas in Texas. Dakar in Senegal rather than Dakar in Bangladesh. So a proper travel agent will help you avoid those problems. But I meant more things like you spell your name very slightly wrong. An ordinary travel agent going direct to the airline, they will sort it all out in a trice. Online travel agents will quite often say, oh, sorry, yeah, you've lost all your money. You've got to buy a completely new trip. And that appears to be part of the business model, knowing that one in 10, 20 people will make a mistake and they are absolutely going to cash in.
That's just mean, isn't it? Mark Carter, who's from BBC Sussex and BBC Surrey, he says, how many requests do you receive in a typical week for radio and TV interviews? Now, I have a vested interest in this one because the stuff that you don't get, I get maybe about, pick up about 10% of your work. And I have a confession to make. I have this joke when I go and see TV and radio people and they've asked me to come in. I was like, and actually other people, when they say, what do you do for a living? And I say, well, do you know Simon Calder? And they say, yes. And I was like, well, I pick up about 10% of his work that he can't do when he's out the country. And then my little joke is, if he disappears, don't come looking to me. And everyone sort of laughs awkwardly. And now you're feeling even more vulnerable in a room on your own with me. But no, it's, yeah, how many requests say?
Depends what's happened. Typical week, zero. Although if it's BBC, Surrey and Sussex, obviously I will do what I can to help them. It all depends what's happening. And you will know that there's no rhyme nor reason to what happens in travel. I'm just constantly amazed that so many things can go wrong. Let's just go back to the late May bank holiday. So it's half term, all the families going away from Stansted, tens of thousands of people, many of whom lost their flights because lightning struck the fuel supply system and therefore everything falls over. So what are your rights? What's happening? Why has it happened? What can you expect the travel companies to do? And I really, really wish I was never, ever asked again, because it would mean that travel was going really quite well and that airlines were telling people what their rights were, so I didn't have to.
And Judith says, where do you go on holiday when you're not going for work? Now, the last time I interviewed you about travel, you used to go to Belgium quite a bit, did you, with
Belgium's
the family?
Great,
I remember the Belgian beaches you talked about.
Oh, well, I moved on from there. That's very nice of you to remember that. To the Polish Riviera, the Costa del Baltic. It's great for young families. Now, I believe your children are, what, 3 and 5? So perfect, not too hot in the summer, and that's a real serious thing, because while the Costa del Sol is great, you know, middle of the day there is not great for children. So you're nice and far north, and it also everything costs almost nothing. It's kind of 1980s prices, and you can get there really cheaply and easily. We flew out to Szczecin in the west of Poland, went all the way along to Sopot and Gdansk in the east, and that was just a perfect holiday, and it's great fun. But to answer the question, where do I go on holiday? Anywhere, frankly, and there is no boundary, no frontier between holiday and work, because I think I probably spend my entire life on holiday pretending to work. Occasionally during a holiday I will have to work, and occasionally during a holiday I will have exactly the same sorts of problems as everyone else. So you remember the volcanic ash cloud 2010?
I do. It almost disrupted my wedding. Well, I was having to fly 80 people to Malaga.
Ooh.
And we were really, really concerned. And there were BA strikes at the time as well.
Oh yeah, cabin crew dispute, yeah.
Yes, there were a whole load of things going on, and luckily it went without a hitch. Now, I know you had problems though, didn't you?
I'd flown over as a scheduled passenger to Norway on SAS, and I came back as freight on a container ship, which was a good way of getting out. I was actually, John Cleese, you might remember at the time, hired a taxi in Oslo and said, take me to London. And that cost him, I think, thousands of pounds. Mine was, I think, 150 quid. It did end up in Immingham, which is the far side of Grimsby. I didn't know there was anything on the far side of Grimsby.
I've never heard of Immingham. Big shout out to everyone in Immingham.
Then I had to make my way back from there, but it was fine. It's all fine.
I've done that before on the way back from Paris, where the Eurostar train, there was an electrical fault with the tunnel, and I realised that with about 1,000 people on each train and loads of trains backing up, we were never going to get out of there. So I got off at, it's Lille, is it?
Lille, yeah.
Yeah, I got off at Lille, got a taxi to the ferry.
No!
Yeah. Got Crikey. A ferry to Dover, got Dover to train to London, and then ultimately down to Brighton. It took, I got back at 1 o'clock in the morning instead of midday or something, but everyone else was still on the train
yes.
and being bussed around and trying to find local hotels and awful
things. Oh, absolutely. I imagine that was not the cheapest way of getting out, but it's always good if you, in the case of disruption,
if you just want to get home, sometimes yeah. you've just got to get home.
And, yeah. And also, don't always, well, while of course you need to listen to what your train company or your airline is saying. I mean, on Eurostar as well, I got stuck the wrong side of a fisherman's strike or something in Calais when they were blocking the Eurostar line. So I was stuck in Lille as well. And they said, right, we're booking you on a train at tea time tomorrow. And I just thought, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get to the station at 5 o'clock in the morning and just get on the first one, and I did that. Similarly, British Airways, we got diverted to Paris on the way to Heathrow, and they said, oh yeah, you know, rebook online. But actually going along to the airport next day and just saying, I'm here, can you fly me, that sort of worked. So
do you keep tally on how many countries you've been to?
No, do you?
Yeah, I did. I can't remember what it was now, but you must have been to 100, surely.
I shouldn't think so. I don't know. I've never counted.
Would you be able to count now?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember all the places I've been to, but I haven't.
I need you to make a count and then tweet us later.
Well, no, that's kind of you. I don't know if I would, and maybe we're straying into the philosophy of travel. But I'm a mathematician by training, so you might think, oh well, it's good to have a number. But I don't know. Travel cannot be quantified like that. You can't say Scotland is a 5-star country and Belgium's a 4-star country. You can't do that. And I don't think you can say, oh, I've travelled more and by implication better than you because I've been to 47 countries and you've only been to 32. Yeah, I don't know if you can do that.
Absolutely. And I think there's nothing, and I like the fact that you're not snotty about travel, and I'm not really snotty about travel. I think there's no shame in going for a week, a package holiday in Tenerife, you know, compared to some exotic resort.
I would say that generally it's better to go for a package holiday to Tenerife than almost all of the trips that I try, which are slightly more adventurous, because they tend to go quite wrong. And and Tenerife always beckons. And the great thing about Tenerife, since you mention it, as you know, there's so much there. You can climb Spain's highest mountain, Teide. You have to sort out permits and things, but that's a great thing to do. Some astonishing walking on the northwestern side. There's day hikes there you can do, which are frankly the compare of anything anywhere in Europe. And of course you've got Playa Las Americas and Los Cristianos.
It's there if you want it,
and
isn't it?
Puerta, yeah, and also, I mean, you've got a proper city, Santa Cruz. Therefore, it's everything you want. It's a kind of almost a perfect little country. Ditto Gran Canaria, which in a sense has even more appealing history. I don't know. They're all great. El Hierro, I don't know if you've been there, have you?
I haven't been to El
Hierro. Okay, it was one of the relatively few that you can't fly to direct, along with Gomera. But El Hierro is where they used to put the meridian saying, this is the end of Europe, stop here, it's 0 degrees, because, well, you could go over there, but frankly, you'd probably fall off, so don't.
Yeah, the Canaries weren't on my radar at all until I had kids, and life has changed. You know, I was too busy going to the Southeast Asia and all these exotic places. And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I got it out of the way, because I certainly don't want to go to any of those long... I don't want to take a 5-year-old, for example, to India at the moment. I just can't deal with the pressure. You see families when I was there.
Yeah.
I saw families in remote places in Cambodia or Vietnam. But I don't want to do that personally.
It can work for families. You've got to be really careful. You've got to listen to your kids, because if your kids are traumatised by travel, then they're not going to enjoy it, which would be a terrible thing, because, as you know and I know, it is perhaps the greatest gift of the 21st century is that we are able to travel far and wide at costs relative to incomes, which is way lower than anything else.
Travel has changed, though, hasn't it? What do you think of the whole Instagram generation, where the place and the visual aspect seems to be a little bit more important, what they're portraying to their viewing public, than it is actually experiencing?
It's great. It's all communications, it's all contact. Now, it used to be the case that the sole form of communication was just one way. You would send a postcard, and that the postcard is not yet completely dead.
I wish more people would send me postcards. I love postcards. In fact, I'm going to do a shout out to get postcards. We've got listeners in 80 different countries on the podcast. I should try and get everyone. I'll find an address and try and get people to send us some postcards.
Find an address. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yes, people can find you in 2 seconds online, but an actual physical address where you send a postcard. It's great, and I don't suppose anybody listening to this will remember Poste Restante, where if you were going off on a great long trip through Southeast Asia or Latin America or whatever, people could contact you, but you would need to say, I think I'm going to be in Lima in the third week in February, so please, if you've got anything to say, send it in a letter to Poste Restante in Lima, and you go along there, join a great long queue of other gringos with your passport, and they'd sort through and it might be under C for Calder, or it might be under S for Simon, or indeed
something completely different.
I for Inglés. Yes.
So that sounds amazing. I wish that still happened.
Well, I think in theory it may still happen, but it was a wonderful way of communicating, because it's just one of these things. Is there going to be a letter for me? Isn't there? Oh, it's freak.
Where's the most remote place you've been to?
That's a very good question. Depends how you define remote. South Georgia, probably. But that's quite a long way from anywhere, even the Falklands. And it is this miraculous island. Very, very long, very rugged. And, of course, this is where Ernest Shackleton ended up crashing into the wrong side of the island and then climbing across this astonishing mountain range after a 40-day, it might be 20, it might be 60-day journey, when they were just guessing that probably if they carried on long enough, they'd reach South Georgia, and then climbed over this astonishing mountain range, having been living on seals for weeks, and made their way to town and rescued everybody. It was possibly the greatest travel story ever. And you really do feel as though there's not much else. I mean, I know people can get to the South Pole, and, well, maybe that'd be a nice thing to do one day, but it's not very scenic, from what I understand. It's not very culturally rich, and those two things are sort of quite important, and probably the food's rubbish as well.
Is there any time you've felt scared or out of your comfort zone when you're traveling?
Yeah, but that's part of the fun, isn't it? It's fun. It's part of the experience all the time. Yes, I mean, since I was 6 and went with the Woodcraft Folk, great youth organisation, still going, soon to celebrate its 100th anniversary, to the Lake District. My lovely late parents decided, I mean, that my mum always had this fantastic rule, which was, if you haven't heard anything to the contrary, everything's sure to be all right. And that was great, and it's such a difference now from the way that, and I don't know if you're like this, you need to be aware of where your children, where your family are at all times. She just thought, oh well, they'll probably be all right, and I'll hear if they're not. And that was great. And so she sent me and my very slightly elder sister, who was 7, to the Lake District on a Woodcraft Folk trip. And there we were, and I wandered off and got lost and had to find my way back and everything. That was very uncomfortable, I recall. But it all sort of worked out all right since. And I suppose the other one would be, how's your fear of heights?
It's not that bad, actually.
Okay.
Well, it's not like I've climbed Kilimanjaro or anything. But
well, I've got a terrible fear of heights, and I do climb high mountains, I think, to try to get past that, and it is sort of working. It's taking a bit of time, as you can tell, but Mount Kenya, which is the one, and this is a fantastic geographical phenomenon, the highest view you can have in the world, the longest view you can have in the world, is from the top of Kilimanjaro to the top of Mount Kenya, or vice versa. It's 200 miles, and because they are both standing proud of the kind of the flat ground in between, you can see that distance. So that's quite a thing. But it would have been, about half a dozen people fall off Mount Kenya every year, and I was really keen not to be one of them. And here's something you could do, which I would strongly recommend everybody who's listening to, because you can do it, and you might think, I can't do that, but you can. You can be the highest person in the world, and you do that by climbing Aconcagua, which is in Argentina, close to the Chilean border. And it's the highest mountain outside the Himalayas. I think it's, what, 23,000 feet? I can't remember. Seemed quite a long way. And in December or January, which is the only time you can climb it, there isn't anybody climbing really high mountains in the Himalayas. So by definition, if you get to the top, you're the highest person in the world, even though you come from Crawley or wherever, and you're not particularly fit, but you don't need to be. It's just a matter of plodding. There's very, very few places you could fall off, and I didn't. And in altitude terms, I was out of my comfort zone, because you do really have to acclimatise, and there's checks all the time to see how well you're coping with the altitude.
But describe to me what it's like. What does it look like? I've only ever been to Buenos Aires. I haven't climbed any mountains.
Oh, okay. Well, the Argentina, what a great, great country. They're having a terrible time economically at the moment, but hopefully that will result in them sorting out their currency and everybody going to Argentina.
It's been trouble. When I went, it was just after the crash. I forget what year it was, but the currency was still really, really low. And I remember wandering around the shops and thinking, because the dollar sign is the same as the US dollar sign. And I was thinking, oh, that's, you know, looking in windows, trying to gauge the sort of prices, thinking, oh, that's okay. You know, more expensive than I thought it was. But then I realised it was the local currency, and it was three times as low as I thought it was. So we realised we were rich. You know, we were going into the best restaurants in Buenos Aires, and they were dusting down bottles of wine from the shelf. And we were like, what's your most expensive bottle of wine? We didn't actually say that, because it makes it sound like idiots, but looking at the menu, it's like, let's get that one. That's 14 quid. We could afford the best bottle of wine in this very, very posh restaurant.
Oh, fantastic.
And people were just treating us like gods. It felt amazing. Obviously, it wasn't very good for the local people who had lost all their money, but it meant for a very good trip for us.
Yeah, and maybe just before we get on to the rest of Argentina, let's just pause on that point, because it's so important. You might feel as though you're exploiting countries which are recovering from economic catastrophe, or indeed from warfare, but actually, by being a tourist, you are doing lots of virtuous things. You're bringing foreign exchange, which is very useful. You're creating jobs, because you're demanding meals and accommodation and so on. So tourism is generally a pretty good way of transferring wealth from richer countries to poorer countries, and doing good stuff. I mean, it can go to extremes, and but if the local, which you've seen in the whole over tourism debate in Barcelona and Dubrovnik and Santorini and so on, but that's, I think, for the local residents via their local governments to control.
It's a hard one. We'll get back to your mountain in a minute, but you've got the beach in Thailand at the moment where the beach was filmed, and that's just been closed for several months, which I think is a great, very brave decision, because they will lose a lot of revenue, but they'll lose a hell of a lot more revenue if everything gets completely destroyed and people don't want to go back there.
Yes, you do have to ask what were they thinking when they allowed things to get quite so awful, and whether when it finally reopens, you actually put a kind of cost element in and say you're not allowed to go to Koh Phi Phi until you've paid $100 or something, and what the morality of that is. But the local community holds all the cards. It can do what it wants. It can, as in the case of Barcelona, ban Airbnbs on an industrial scale. And what I'm hearing has been happening in Barcelona is that you get an apartment block, and people who previously invested in hotels would invest in an apartment block and just say, we're going to let it all out on Airbnb. And that obviously distorts the local economy. But you know, they've got all the levers. They can control that.
So you're up a mountain in Argentina. What was it like? You became the highest person in the world.
Which is quite surprising. So Argentina, most of it very kind of low-lying, which is why you've got such fantastic steaks. In the west, you run up against the Andes, and once it starts getting high, then you get to beautiful city of Mendoza and all the wonderful wine lands around there. And then you go on for 100 miles or so, and there's a sort of turn off saying Aconcagua that way. It's not the most appealing mountain you could ever imagine. It's bleak, it's just raw rock, and you just plod your way up it. And
are you climbing? Are you physically climbing? Do you need, have you got ropes and things? Or is it a bit like...
No, it's a long old walk.
No, sorry,
walk.
No, don't you?
No, Ben Nevis.
It's Ben Nevis, isn't it?
Ben Nevis. Well, I think Snowdonia as well. You can perfectly happily walk up without anything. Base camp is quite funny because I can't remember what you had. Maybe 11,000 feet, and it's a real kind of shanty town, but with it, yeah, there's all good fun. And then you just keep plodding. You've got your tent. You have to make lots and lots of repeat journeys, partly because you've got to put supplies higher up in order to be there when you start climbing, but mostly just to adjust to the very thin atmosphere. And then you just have to be lucky with the weather. And I got there, and 25 minutes after we got to the top, I was there with a friend of mine called Graham and his partner Gina. He climbs proper mountains like Everest, so I had no idea what he was doing asking me along. But we got there, took all the photos, looked around, and yes, you can see the rest of the world laid out before you. And then the snow came in, and the very good rangers on the mountain just said, all right, everybody down. They just led us all down to safety. And then I dare say it was closed for another 3 weeks or something after that. So
was it exhilarating?
Exhilarating, that's a very good word. No, because you're very, very weary. I mean, you've got up at 3 o'clock in the morning after having a terrible night's sleep because there's three of you sharing a tent intended for two people. You've then had one of the toughest days of your life physically, just in terms of climbing up, and it gradually steepens, and then the kind of rock turns to rubble, and so you're clambering up there, and it's awful. And so, and also you're thinking, ooh, what's that? Oh, it's snow coming in. So you're thinking, ooh, how do I get out of that? When it's great is when you get back to something you've recognised as civilization, which in my case was the fine city of Santiago across the border in Chile. And then you just go out for a steak and a glass of wine, and you think,
oh, wine's lovely.
Yeah, you just think that was an adventure. And you also, it helps put things in context. So it really doesn't matter. I didn't miss beer. I didn't miss being online. Of course, I missed the big travel podcast, although I'm not mistaken, it didn't exist then. So, but if it had done, I certainly would have missed it. But I would have luckily taken lots of downloads and listened to them. And it's just
switch off for a while.
Switch off, or you're always just, you're all just contemplating this target. So it focuses, everything, it comes down to just getting to the top of this thing.
I've got this visual. I think you should team up with Bear Grylls and maybe do a Simon Calder Bear
Grylls series. No, because
he's proper.
No, he's a proper person. I'm gonna
propose that to the people.
Well, that's very nice. But he's a professional. Yeah, I'm very keen in being an enthusiastic amateur. Because lots of other people can be enthusiastic amateurs too and do these things. You would be great at it. You'd scamper up in
I'm more
in
about
a couple
the,
of days.
I'm more about the family travel these days. Those are the only commissions I'm taking. I want to take them on experiences as well. I want to see the Northern Lights, which I've never seen. I want to, do sort of family experiences.
Yeah.
And the Galapagos, I'd love to take my boys to because they're big animal fans.
Right. Okay. I thought you were going to say big animals.
Yeah, they are big animals as well, actually.
Right. Okay. So Northern Lights, I've been lucky enough to see them a few times. I absolutely, unreservedly recommend the following. It's not the cheapest holiday you're going to have, but it's hugely subsidised by the nice Norwegian government. So
it's very
you
nice of them.
Fly to Bergen in Norway, which you can do relatively cheaply. You get on the Hurtigruten, which means Coastal Express, and it's this ferry. Every night the ferry departs from Bergen. It takes 12 days to sail around to Kirkenes, right by the Russian border. So it's a long old way, and it sails all the way back. And this is a social service. It's public transport for all these coastal communities. But if they didn't have Brits paying pretty good rates on it, it would be empty. So they give us a really, really good deal. You get all your fantastic food, and the food on board is great. And you get to enjoy the superb coastal scenery, and you get to see all these lovely communities, and you get the Northern Lights, to the extent that if you don't see the Northern Lights, if you're going at a sensible time, and that's my view, end of October, end of February, because that means you get Northern Lights plus fantastic scenery. If you don't see them, then they'll give you another cruise. So
that sounds amazing. That's the thing, when now you've got kids in tow, it's four tickets when you go anywhere. I used to go many places on my own and also go on press trips and things, but family travel gets so expensive because of that.
Well, except that the prospect of finding a ticket to Norway for 50 quid, if you go back 20, 25 years, that was simply...
Yes, we're very lucky.
£500.
So yes, it's only comparatively expensive. Yeah. Year on year, you know, decade after decade, it's got cheaper thanks to budget airlines and the democratisation, I guess, of travel.
Democratisation, that's exactly what's happened. And of course, the media has also become democratised, and that's very good. And that's why Instagram, to answer your earlier question, and everything else, WhatsApping, your nearest and dearest and saying, here we are, is great.
It is indeed. So I got my people to speak to your people, which is just me emailing you and your wife. It's nothing glamorous like that. Just to get a few highlights, because I just thought, where do I start with Simon and his travel? So I've got a few quick fire questions to ask you about.
Good idea. Yeah.
Tell me about Crawley and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right, Crawley wasn't directly involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis, but this event in 1962 was when the Soviet Union, as then was, thought, oh, I'll tell you what, we've got this close friend in the shape of Cuba, we could put some nuclear missiles there, and then they'd be really close to America, who we hate. So let's do that then. President Kennedy said, oh, we know what you're up to, because we've got good reconnaissance aircraft. At the time, the satellites weren't so good. So please stop it. And the world held its breath. Now, I was six, so therefore I wasn't exactly holding my breath. But what I did know was that my parents had worked out that Crawley had a missile with its name on it. Not specifically because of antipathy towards this lovely Sussex new town, but because it was very close to Gatwick Airport. I was born and brought up 2 miles from the runway. So therefore, if they're going to target Gatwick Airport, that would be inconvenient for the family. So they looked at how far away can we afford to get, and the answer was beautiful Guernsey in the Channel Islands. So we all flew off there, and going from, you know, the idea of a holiday might be on a really, really good summer, you might get as far as Dorset, to getting into an aeroplane and flying to an island was just the most exciting thing.
Was that where you got the travel bug, do you think?
I think I got that slightly earlier. If I was born in a house on the A23.
It's great for transport links.
Well, yeah, and 2 miles from Gatwick Airport, so we used to go to the airport, obviously not to get on a plane, just to have a look at the what was going on, because it was all very exciting. And if you come from Crawley, you kind of suspect that the world may have more to offer. So
Crawley, yeah. Crawley's perfect like that. It's pretty shit, and it's got great transport links, the airport, yeah. The motorways, it's brilliant.
Yeah, I suppose so, yes.
So your first job was, one of your first jobs was frisking people at Gatwick Airport.
Well, just before that I was a cleaner, and that was good in the olden days when you didn't need much in the way of security. And yeah, I was cleaner for British Airways. You just wander onto the airfield and wander onto the planes. I can't believe that we were allowed to do it. But then things got, you know, people started hijacking planes, not from Gatwick, but security became a thing. And so I got a job at the airport frisking people. And again, you just think, oh, these lucky people flying off and having fantastic times. And because the cost of aviation was so expensive, you thought, well, I'm never going to be able to do this. So, first time I went to Spain, 1975, I finished work at the airport frisking people. I then got on a train to New Haven. I got on a ferry to France. I then hitchhiked all the way down to Spain, because clearly it was the only way to get there.
That's what we did, actually. When I meant to we moved to Spain in 1981, and I was 6 years old. We got the coach down. My mum, dad, and two children spent 3 days getting the coach down. That's how we moved there.
No,
from the north of England to Malaga. Yeah.
Oh my goodness me.
Well, we didn't. Yeah. We couldn't afford the flights, and that's how you. I think more people were flying then, but you know, we weren't. But they were campers and camper van people, so they were used to that sort of thing. Getting mugged in Costa Rica.
It's annoying when you get attacked and mugged and stuff abroad. Luckily, it doesn't happen very often. It didn't happen on my birthday, so I was born on Christmas Day, and this was Christmas Day 1999. And Charlotte, my lovely wife, didn't have any children at the time, so we were travelling the length of the Pan American Highway through Central America, and we got to San Jose on Christmas Eve, thanks to a superbly brilliant lift down through the mountains from the Nicaraguan border. And right, Christmas Day, it's going to be really busy. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to the bus station as listed in the rough guide to buy my our tickets down to the Panamanian border. And I went to the bus station, found a security guard who said, yeah, you're the 17th person this week to come here, the bus station has moved, it's now across town, and I looked at my map and I thought, right, well, I'll cut across this slightly dodgy area, of course, which is never a good thing to do. This guy came up behind me, grabbed me by the throat, and I just thought, hang on, he's not grabbing me by the throat very well. So I managed to yank his arm away and then just ran. But it was upsetting. I got finally to the bus station because I didn't abandon my mission at this stage. And they said, you're too late, senor, all the tickets are gone. So we had fun
Happy
that day.
Happy Christmas.
Well, it was Christmas Day. But no, things worked out really well because we thought, right, we're going to carry on hitching. And we were racing the bus all the way down and, in fact, beating it.
You've had a few hitches while hitching. I've got a listing here in my my list of suggestions. Hanging onto the back of a dust cart in Turkey, hitching into someone's garage by accident, getting a lift in a digger in Greece, and getting a lift in the boot of a car in Germany.
Oh, yeah. The last two were really quite recent. In Greece, maybe 5 summers ago, we'd all gone off to the beautiful island of Poros with the family, and I thought, I've got to do a day of independent travel. So I went, got the ferry across to Idra, and then the boat across to the mainland, and all I needed to do was hitch back. But it was a really, really, really terrible day for hitchhiking, and I ended up walking for miles and got a lift in the digger of a, or in the bucket bit of a truck, and that was fine. It took me for about 5 miles or so. And I was very grateful for it. Not the most glamorous way to travel, but there we are. And then
they knew you were in there. You weren't a stowaway.
Oh no! They did. They thought it was quite funny, and they luckily kept it low. If they decided, oh, let's see how high it can go with him, that might be a little bit worrying. Then, well, another kind and careful driver, a couple of years ago, Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, right in southern Germany, just by the Austrian border, where Mad King Ludwig built his castle. It is just one of the supreme joys of Europe, and I urge you to go and see it. But it's so popular, particularly with tourists from the Far East, that you have to get to Neuschwanstein first thing in the morning, 9 o'clock, and they'll say, right, you can go and see this castle now, this one now. The first one we've got tickets for is 6 o'clock for the main castle. So okay, and then again, maybe I just shouldn't wander off on my own. I wandered off on my own with a dodgy map. I got lost. 5 to 6, I was over a mile away at the bottom of the hill with the castle at the top of the hill, and no way of going there, knowing this was the last tour and we were leaving first thing next morning, so it was my only chance ever. And the only way I was going to get there was if I was hitching. And look, here comes a blue Mercedes estate, and the blue Mercedes estate stopped, and I could see that there was absolutely no room in it. It was bung full of people and baggage. But the driver, realising that I was in some distress, said, tell you what, why don't you stand on the bumper at the back and we'll drive you up to the top. So I did. I stood on the bumper. There's a handy piece of trim you can hang on to. And we drove up to the top. He dropped me off and I ran in literally as the door was closing. So many good people out there. And a very good way to discover how many there are is by hitching.
It's lovely that people are still hitching. I mean, how many people do you think are still out there doing it apart from you? I mean, obviously you can't count them, but do you think it's still quite common?
No, I can count them. I've got to 2 so far. That's me and Tony Wheeler, the founder of Lonely Planet, who's even older than me. It all depends. In Eastern Europe, coming out of Ljubljana on a Friday evening, lots and lots of hitchhikers. And last year in Scotland, I found myself in a queue of hitchhikers leaving Ullapool. So there's a few people doing it. And look, in the olden days in Crawley, I did it because it was the only economic way of getting anywhere, which is why you ended up on a bus going to Malaga. Now I do it if there is no alternative, and quite often that's the case. So I was in Hadrian's Wall, which is a lovely place. You finish walking at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. I needed to get to the north of Scotland. No way of doing it by public transport, so all you can do is hitch up the A68 and the A9 and then you get there. But what's changed is that with stuff online, it makes it so much easier. So night was falling, we were approaching Aviemore, and I could, with my phone, actually think, oh, hang on, I've got to find a B&B, find one, and then with the map just say, drop me off here if you could, I'm going to stay in the B&B. So
people must think now, because you're so well known, do people not go, hang on a sec, that's Simon Calder, I'm going to give him a lift, obviously not in Bavaria.
No, normally they drive past at an ever-increasing rate, and they're
disappointed. Oh, God, look at Simon Calder, not picking him up.
No, but I get mistaken for other people, so therefore the generally huge disappointment when they discover I'm not who they thought I was.
Who do they think you are?
Nicholas Crane, who does the Coast programme. He's very good indeed. Yes, you should see the way people's faces sink when I say, I'm so sorry, it's not me. To the extent that I've now started sort of signing his name, if it's really going to upset them, I will sign his name.
Yeah, hi, I'm Nicholas.
And Louis Theroux, oddly.
Really?
Yeah, quite. I don't know why.
Louis Theroux?
Yes.
I suppose you're tall.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm slim. Often accosted, but I suspect it's because people think I owe them money or something. Anyway.
Talking of money, I've only got a couple more questions, but the man who pays his way, how does that work? I mean, I know as a travel professional that I certainly not travelling, doing it so much at the moment, but I used to go on a lot of paid press trips. And sometimes these are by the tourist boards, but in my case, a lot of the time it was paid by luxury hotels who want you to write nice things about them. And I've got no qualms about that because they're always really nice. There's only one time that I felt I couldn't give someone a review, and that was this hotel in the Maldives, which was just riddled with mosquitoes, and I wanted to leave. Imagine wanting to leave the Maldives. Yeah. I went to a beautiful hotel in the Maldives and wrote that up instead, and that was all very well. So I'm quite partial. I know you're very impartial, but a lot of travel writers are partial because they are taken to these beautiful places and shown the best sides of it. Well, and the places are wonderful. Now, the man who pays his way was your idea for The Independent, and you paid your way, basically. You didn't accept freebies. Is that still what you're doing, and how does it work?
Oh, well, look, if I give you a bit of background, The Independent, when it started in 1986, always had a no freebies policy. And the great Frank Barrett, the travel editor there, originally hired me to do some writing because I didn't take any free trips. That wasn't actually because I thought, I'm going to be holier than thou. I'm going to not take any free trips. It's because nobody would give me any. So therefore, it was quite straightforward. He then left, and they, in a moment of madness in 1994, gave me his job. And of course, there was still no freebies. And that was fine because I kind of quite like that sort of travel and things. The more you travel in the same way as everyone else, the more things go horribly wrong. So you've got lots to write about. Then in 2000 or 2003 or something, the travel section at The Independent expanded so much that it simply wouldn't work. You couldn't fill the pages and have people who didn't take free trips. So the policy changed, but mine didn't. And therefore, in order to sort of say that, this slogan was devised. I can't remember by whom. And that's what I've continued to do. I hope it doesn't sound as though I'm being critical or pious or anything. It's just it's a difference, and there we are. But you and lots of other people write great stuff on the basis of trips where you haven't paid for stuff.
And I think you can trust. There's a massive debate going online at the moment, probably something you don't read, but in Mumsnet there's a huge debate about Instagram influencers, mainly mummy bloggers as they're called, and what they say they've been given or gifted or hashtag ad, and how ethical it is for them to suddenly be getting these very expensive designer handbags. And some of them have been holidays when their followers initially followed them because they're like talking about their mummy lives or whatever it is mummy life bloggers talk about. With the travel industry, I don't have the same ethical issues because you are going to beautiful places. And I know many, many travel writers, and no one has ever given a great review to somewhere that they don't believe in. So I think you can, although it is sponsored and paid for most of the time, not with you, obviously, I think you can trust them.
Oh, yes, of course. There's great travel writers out there I have the greatest admiration for. But It's just a point of difference. I agree that, I think the way that social media has democratised travel writing is fantastic. Competition is a very, very good thing. And opening up the whole world of blogging to is terrific. And it's great the way that people seize those opportunities. I think all the public wants to know is, how did this come about? If you've, as it says at the end of your articles and broadcasts and so on, you know, travelled as a guest of, that's fine. I can then draw my own conclusions. It's just when that's not entirely clear that possibly an issue.
Transparency is the key.
Transparency, that's the word, yes. Why didn't I just say transparency? Much quicker.
I'm coming up with it. Transparency, democratisation. Yeah. I can barely say these words normally. Before I ask you my last question, do you think there's anything I've missed?
Stories? That sounds like the Inland Revenue, isn't it? Or HMRC, yeah. Is there anything you need to tell us about?
Nope, nothing at all.
Well, yes, there is. I think it's really important, but you'll be the judge of that. I'm a mathematician. I look at numbers in terms of risk the whole time. And I am so, so grateful that we are living at the safest time ever to be travellers. And that's actually, it's almost banal what's happened, but generally, very sadly, about 600 people who can be classed as holidaymakers or travellers die abroad every year, British people. That's been constant pretty much for the last 25, 30 years. And yet, the numbers of travelling have almost doubled in that time. And so therefore the risks are reducing all the time. And it's largely due to better road safety in places like Spain and Portugal and France and so on. So we're safer than we've ever been. And yet I think a lot of people perceive exactly the opposite, which things are more dangerous than they've ever been. And that's such a shame if it stops people travelling to wonderful places and opening up their eyes to great things that are happening. Terrorism is terrible. The attacks we've seen on tourists are unspeakably awful, but they are so incredibly rare that dwelling on them is like dwelling on the risk of flying. You know, aviation, if you're lucky enough to be in the UK, you have access to the safest aviation in the world. It's a fantastic time to be a traveller. Worry about crossing the road, particularly if you're on your phone or you're Instagramming. Worry about accidents in water. Don't worry about anything else. Just go out there and see the world.
I love that. I think you're right. It's the 24-hour news culture. We're far more aware of things that go on these days, and it has made people a little bit maybe more risk averse. And it is a wonderful time for travel. It's cheaper than it's ever been comparatively. The world is more open than it has been, and I agree with you. So my last question, and I know nothing about your taste in music, so this is very interesting. My last question is always about music, because to me, music and travel go hand in hand.
Yeah.
People listen to music a lot when they're traveling, you have more time. And the question is, if you had to pick one song that reminds you of a time and a place of travel that evokes some beautiful memories or something funny or anything stand out, what would that song be?
Undoubtedly Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound by Tom Paxton. Okay, there's great lines in it. Nail my boots to the kitchen floor, lace them up and bolt the door in order to stop people travelling. And this is only because it's the worst holiday ever. I booked it. I was solely responsible for it. I booked the family to go on an incredibly expensive Arctic cruise with a company called Adventure Canada. We started in Greenland. The bit in Greenland was fine, and then we got on the boat and everything went downhill from there. We didn't end up going to two-thirds of the places we were supposed to. That my lovely daughters on this boat, which was sailing around in circles for days on end with no internet, could not have been nicer, but they had a I'll use the term loosely, a talent night. And so I just got up and I sang Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound. But I don't think anybody got the joke.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast, Simon Calder.
Fantastic. How did you do it?
Oh,
gosh,
that's lovely.
So good at this.
Thank you so much, Simon, and thank you for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Like I said, if you're enjoying the podcast, please head over to iTunes and write us a nice review, and make sure you subscribe from whatever podcast app you're using. It would be much appreciated. Looking forward to seeing you again soon.